In 2015, when the award-winning journalist John Leland set out on behalf of the New York Times to meet members of America's fastest-growing age group, those 85 and up, he anticipated learning of challenges of loneliness and of the deterioration of body, mind, and quality of life. But the elders he met took him in an entirely different direction. Despite disparate backgrounds and circumstances, they each lived with a surprising lightness and contentment. The reality Leland encountered upended contemporary notions of aging, revealing the late stages of life as unexpectedly rich and the elderly as incomparably wise. Happiness is a Choice You Make is his book. It's a collection of lessons that emphasizes, above all, the extraordinary influence we wield over the quality of our lives. And it's a great pleasure to welcome journalist John Leland to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
What brought you to this particular subject?
Well, I'm a newspaper reporter at the New York Times, in the Metro section, and in 2015, I set out to do a year-long series about people 85 and up, because they're one of the fastest-growing age groups in the country. So I spent the year following six people of different ethnicities, classes, or living in different living situations, and then when it was over, I missed them so much that I had to do something, so I wrote a book about them.
What did you miss?
My time with them. What I realized was that the time I spent with these six people, just listening to them, had really changed me in profound ways. I was much more relaxed with who I was. I was happier day to day. I was sort of, I'm a newspaper reporter. I'm a grumpy guy. But in the time with them, I felt myself giving away a lot of that, just like letting go a lot of the anger that I had, letting go some of the resentments that I had. You know, my life was just a lot lighter. And I thought, like, how is it I'm spending time with these people who are, you know, toward the end of their lives and had all of them some serious problems, and yet I was cheered up by that.
Let me ask you about the phrase oldest old, of how you define that, how you would like us to think of that as we enter into the book.
Oh, yeah, that comes from demographers and gerontologists who think of people 85 and up as being different from people, say, 70 to 84.
So not elderly, it's the oldest old.
It's the oldest old. But now people are saying, no, really, we have to have a separate category for centenarians. And some people feel we need a separate category for super centenarians, meaning people who are 110 and up.
So the starter here is happiness. And the title of the book, Happiness is a Choice You Make. So that idea of happiness, where do you find it? Where do they find it?
I think they find it in living their lives in the moment, rather than worrying about what's in the offing that you don't have. A man named Fred Jones said to me, happiness is what's happening now. It's not the next world. It's not the dance you're going to tonight. If you're not happy in the present moment, you're not happy. And I think that's a great way of looking at it. It's a way of embracing whatever it is you're going through at any given time, even though there might be hardships. I mean, this guy, he was living alone in a walk-up apartment, and he had gangrene in two of his toes. So it was a hard life that he was living, but he just embraced it every day. And what I realized was that was just a choice that Fred made. You know, it wasn't that his life was so good that made him happy, but it was because he chose to find happiness in the life that he had.
So that time of life obviously has a lot of challenges just built in. Illness, the death of friends and loved ones. It can be a straining time with family and friends. So that comes into the equation, doesn't it?
Yeah, I set out to write a year about what a miserable write for a year about what a miserable thing
how
it
horrible
was to
this was going
to
yeah. be. Right?
I thought, you know, like you fall down, you break your hip, and life goes to heck. You know, like you lose your memory and then life goes all downhill. And what I found is that the people had the challenges that I expected to find, but they didn't define their lives by these things.
What was your feeling of aging going in, of how you felt about getting older?
I think it was what everybody says. It's a miserable thing. It's the thing that the last thing you want to do is get old.
Right.
You know, we think that people who are old past a certain age, they don't work anymore and they don't have sex anymore. And so it's almost like not existing in American society. And what I found was that all the people just made the most of their lives as they were. You know, and I think about this, there was one woman in particular who was a great model for this. She just, every day she adjusted to the world as it came at her with the body she had and the resources she had, instead of being bitter that one of those things wasn't different than it was.
One of the things that you talk about in the book that I found fascinating is that people who are among the oldest old now and living well into their 80s and 90s, you point out, are really pioneers, because this is the generation that is living this long for the first time.
Yeah, we never had this many older people as we do now. And demographers used to talk about an aging pyramid where there was really wide at the bottom with all the children being born, and really narrow at the top, because after 65, 70 or so, there weren't people there. And the people in this book who are 85 and up, they were born with a life expectancy of about 60 years or so. So they had lived, you know, full lives after they'd passed life expectancy.
While you were doing this, you were dealing with the health of your mother as well.
Mm-hmm. Still am. My mother's 89. She broke her hip in March, and so she's got a new hip replacement, and she's dealing with that. And my mother struggles with life in old age. She's got a lot of pain, and she misses my father terribly. And she's still upset at my brother and I for authorizing a feeding tube that kept her alive after one of her operations. And it was kind of a harrowing experience for us. I was on assignment in Baghdad at the time. My brother was here, and we were looking at her DNR, a do not resuscitate order, and trying to figure out what her wishes were. And they said that she didn't want to be revived if she was going to live in a persistent vegetative state and have no quality of life. And we thought that didn't apply now. It didn't apply to the circumstances at hand. So we authorized the feeding tube to get her through this infection that she had, and she survived, and she's like, why didn't you just let me go?
How does that make you feel? I mean, obviously you want your mother around as long as you can have her around, and yet you also want to abide by her wishes.
Well, I think we didn't know her wishes as well as we do now at the time. If it were to come up again, we would not authorize the feeding tube because we understand her better now. But at the same time, I think my mother is glad she had those years in between. She just doesn't want 3 years from now.
And maybe doesn't want you to know that she's enjoying those years.
Have you been talking to my mother?
Well, I mean, that's just the thing too, right? I mean, that's also to not admit that maybe just at that point giving up would have been easier.
You know, it's so interesting. I had this experience with two of the people in the book and my mother at the same time. I was at my mother's holiday party, and my mother is kind of, as I said, sort of gloomy and depressive. And we were at her holiday party, and one of her friends is saying, oh, Dorothy is the one who is like the leader of this thing that we do. So I thought, like, my impression of my mother was very different from the ones that her friends had. And at around the same time, the daughters of two of the women in the book were telling me, oh, my mother's not in good shape. She's really fallen off. And I would interview the mothers, and they'd be like, oh, my daughter exaggerates. I'm, you know, everything's fine. So I thought, like, we as the kids tend to misjudge our elders and not realize the richness of their lives, and they're living in that richness.
How was your mother's story different than the six people that you followed and spent this year with?
It's a great question, but what I would say is that each of the six people's life story was much different from each other. So she was it was more that my relationship with her was different from my relationship with the others, because I would go to see Fred Jones or Ping Wong or Jonas Mekas, who are people in the book, and they would tell me about their lives. And then I would go to see my mother, and I would try to fix her problems. And it was a very different relationship. And I started to change the way I dealt with my mother based on my relationships with these other people. And I started to just, instead of trying to fix problems in my mother's life, just to listen to her about what her life was like and say, you know, it's not my job to fix mom. She's her own person and she can live her own life. And it made our relationship, you know, much stronger and warmer.
All of the people that you talk to in the book were at various, I guess it's safe to say we're all frail, right?
Yeah, except for Jonas Mekas. I would say they all have some level of frailty. And then Jonas does now, too.
The original idea and what you wanted to accomplish with them and in spending the time with them and in that observation, what was that time like? Because it really becomes a lot of questions, but also quality time that you're spending with these individuals.
It was great. I'd never had the luxury of spending a year with somebody, let alone to spend a year with six people. So as a journalist, I went into the project thinking I'm going to guide the conversations. I want to know their answers to these questions, and I'm going to hold their feet to the fire to get these answers. But then as the year went along, I realized that I would get more if I just let them lead the conversations. They knew more about being 90 than I did. You know, I'd never been 90. They'd all been 90, or 85 at least. And so I just let them guide the conversations, and we followed it wherever it went. Sometimes I would spend a day with somebody, and they would only repeat the things that they'd said the previous times we'd been there. And so I thought, well, if they're repeating these things, that's something that's really important to them, and I'm going to make note of that, rather than say, yep, you already told me that. Let's go on to something else.
Mm. There's I thought of a story in the book that, as I was reading the book, I thought of something that had happened to me recently where I was at a play. I was seeing The Band's Visit, actually. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking across the theater and I saw a gentleman who reminded me of my father's uncle, Uncle Jack. And I thought, oh, my God, that looks a lot like Uncle Jack. And my father had passed and his sister had passed. And that was the relative that Jack had lived with. And, you know, Jack, of course, was, I think he was almost 100 when I had seen him 5 years prior. And and then all of a sudden I said, oh, my God, maybe that is Jack. You know, you think to yourself, oh, Lord, I'd never thought. There was an assumption that he had passed. There was no thought in my mind, given how ill he had been, that this man was still now at 104, not only alive, but out seeing the same show I was on a Thursday night.
Well, this was one of the great things about spending the year with the people, because their lives always surprised me. I went into it thinking, well, I know what their lives are going to be like. And then they were not like that at all. They would just surprise me day to day. They'd be interested in things that I didn't think they'd be interested in. There's a couple that met in a nursing home. And when I met them, they explained to me why they couldn't get married for Social Security reasons. And then one day I visited them and they said, I want to get married. We're going to get married. And then the next time I saw them, the wedding was off because the daughter of one of the people had opposed it. And so they were just surprising. I ended up going on vacation or visiting one of them at their vacation house at the beach at the New Jersey shore.
Mm-hmm.
One of them did readings in a jazz club and I went to see him doing that. Another one, I went with him to his podiatrist and looked at the terrible shape that his feet were in. So it was a way of getting into people's lives. And I'm so grateful for these people for the chance they gave me to enter their lives the way they did.
Part one of the book is called Meet the Elders, and the second part is The Lessons. And you have the lessons of Fred and Ping and John and Helen and Ruth and Jonas. Talk about the lessons, that ultimately the lessons. Were they always apparent, or did you have to ponder them?
It took me a while to learn them all the time, to really start to absorb them. I had this day with Fred where, you know, Fred Jones is the guy who was losing the two toes to gangrene.
Hmm.
And you know, I always wondered why Fred was in such a good mood, even though he had such a hard life. Whereas we all know people who have an easy life, a really comfortable life, and they're just miserable about their lives. And then I talked to Fred, and I asked him his favorite time of the day, and Fred said, waking up in the morning and saying, thank God for another day, on my way to 110. And what I realized was that what made Fred's life worth living was his sense of gratitude. So that was kind of my lesson from Fred, that being grateful and understanding what gratitude meant, that it was a way of looking at the world all the time, could just change our mood. You know, it made our problems look small. And maybe we wouldn't have time for them. So that was like a lesson of Fred. And Helen Moses, who was a woman in the nursing home, she was able to make herself useful to her partner. You know, he was kind of more disabled than she was. And I think the reason her daughter didn't want her to marry him was that he was taking up too much of her energy. But what I realized with Helen was that what she was getting out of it was that he needed her. And, you know, she'd been needed all her life, and now she was needed by Howie. And so there's a lesson there that we should be grateful for the people who let us do things for them, because we get as much out of it as they do.
I'm not saying it is a lesson that I learned in this book, and it's certainly, I don't want to make it as a generalization. However, if there are people in your book who wear the black hats, it's often the children.
Wow, I feel implicated in this.
I'm not implicating you, but in the individuals, I mean, in the stories, the children can have a profound impact, and it's not always positive.
Yeah, I mean, I think as children, we want to take control. And the last thing an older person, for the most part, wants to give up is control.
Right.
So we are the bad guys sometimes. And if we can change, rewire that dynamic, and instead of taking control, listen to what our elders have to tell us, things are going to be not just better for them, but better for us as well. I mean, I often talk about this, that for almost all of human history, almost every society, when they wanted to know something, they turned to their oldest members.
Right.
Not because it was the nice thing to do, but because they got something of value from it. And we've stopped doing that for the most part. And it's not because our elders have gotten stupid. It's because we've gotten more interested maybe in technology. And the people that grow up with the new technologies tend to be better at them. But it doesn't mean that elder wisdom has lost any of its value. And so, you know, for a year, I just had the opportunity to listen and absorb some of this wisdom. And if we, as the children of elders, can do that, we'll find that it's not only better for the elders, but it's better for us as well.
The name of the book is Happiness is a Choice You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. John Leland, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Oh, Joe, thanks so much for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Happiness is a Choice You Make, by John Leland. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.